PhD student in CISA in Trieste, and now he moved into a postdoc in Weizmann. So we're very happy that he was able to join us today, and he will be talking about actions and strings. You can go ahead, Marta. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, especially for the invitation. So since I cannot actually hear you or your reactions, please interrupt me anytime. If I skip some details or I'm not clear, please do interrupt me. So today I'll be talking about some work in collaboration with Ed Hardy and Giovanni Bladoro on actions on strings. So Ed Hardy is a lecturer in Liverpool, Giovanni Bladoro is an ex-PhD advisor in Trieste. And the talk will be based on these two papers, the second of which came out just a few weeks ago. So our goal in these papers is to calculate the QCD axion relic abundance in the so-called post-inflation scenario. And in this scenario, it turns out that it is determined by the decay of topological defects of the axion field, which are cosmic strings and the main walls. So the problem we are addressing in these papers is actually very important theoretically, because besides giving us an understanding of the cosmology and the physics of the axion field in this scenario, which is actually yet far from being completely understood, the scenario actually predicts a unique value for the QCD axion mass. And this value is possibly one of the most important information that theorists can provide in the experimental search for this particle, and also will be crucial in order to interpret any results from experiments. So as you will see, we give for the first time in these papers a convincing proof from first principles, which means from numerical simulations, that strings emit a large amount of axions. And this implies a lower bound on the axion mass, pinning down the axion mass to values of the order of the milli electron volts, so 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, and therefore to significantly restrict the allowed parameter range for this particle in this post inflation scenario. So this is the outline of my talk. I will first give a brief introduction and overview on axion cosmology. It will be very brief, given even the audience. And then I will turn to the main topic of our work, which is a discussion of the dynamics of axion strings. And I will show that a system of axion strings tends asymptotically to a fixed solution, which we call scaling solution. And this scaling solution can be reconstructed from numerical simulations and analytics. And this reconstruction is important and crucial to make any prediction on QCD axion mass. And then, indeed, I will describe which are the implications for the relic abundance and the QCD axion mass. So let's start. So as you know, the QCD axion is possibly one of the most robust solution of the standard Sonsfield problem, and also it automatically forms a dichromatic kind, and it is automatically produced in the early universe. However, the actual QCD axion abundance depends on the cosmological scenario, in particular depends on the hierarchy between the inflation scale and the axion decay constant. So in any case, if FA, the axion decay constant, is larger than the maximum between the Hubble inflation and temperature rating, also known as pre-inflation scenario, the conditions of the axion field in the universe, and due to the exponential expansion of the universe during inflation, the axion field will get smoothed out over distances which are much larger than the Hubble horizon during inflation. And as a result, the axion will be constant, practically homogeneous, every each Hubble patch, acquiring an initial value theta zero, which is A over FA, between zero and pi. And in this scenario, as you know very well, the relic abundance can be calculated in terms of the so-called misaligned mechanism. But however, it depends on theta zero and not only on FA. And therefore, the scenario is not actually really predictive in terms only of the Lagrange parameters, which is only on FA. On the other hand, if, for example, FA is larger than the routine temperature, the universe was in principle hot enough to restore the Petrenko symmetry. So in particular, a temperature is larger than FA, the potential of a scalar field phi, which embeds the axion, would have been generically in its symmetric phase. A temperature over the phase would be a phase transition, and a temperature smaller than that, the potential would be in its broken phase since the temperature collections turn off. And during the first transition, the axon will roll down different points in field space, different points in physical space or in different upper patches, because these are actually causally disconnected. And as a result, after a few Hubble times, these upper patches enter in your horizon, and the axon will be inhomogeneous within the Hubble horizon. And a similar situation of inhomogeneity would happen if the Hubble during inflation is larger than FA. In this case, quantum fluctuations, random quantum fluctuations during inflation, would kick the axon of an amplitude which is larger than FA, because HI is larger than FA, and as a result, it will restore somewhere the perpetual symmetry. So in these two scenarios, which correspond to FA smaller than the maximum between the Hubble during inflation and temperature reading, the axon will have actually random fluctuations over what is the observed horizon today, and actually no free parameters in the initial conditions, as opposed to before, where there was theta zero. And the relic abundance is in principle a function only of the free Lagrangian parameter, the only free Lagrangian parameter, which is FA. And as a result, by requiring that this relic abundance also equals the observed dark matter relic abundance, this corresponds to a prediction for FA, or equivalently, or for a prediction for just the axon mass, since the two are related. And as I said at the beginning, this number, the axon mass, is extremely valuable information for experiments if this scenario actually took place. And if an axon with this mass is discovered, not only will we have an explanation for this dark matter and the strong supertopic, but we also have an handle on early universal cosmology, because we will know that FA should be smaller than the Hubble during inflation, the maximum between the Hubble during inflation and the temperature of overheating. On the other hand, if an axon is discovered, but at another value of the mass, this scenario will be ruled out, because this scenario gives this sharp prediction. But still, we have some information on the early universe, because we know that the pre-inflation scenario would have happened, and so that the axon was homogeneous in the universe. So, in any case,
can I interrupt? That's Sergei Sibiryakov. Yes. It's okay if I will be just asking like that. So, question is: does it depend on the model of the axon, on the potential of this Peachy-Quinn field, or something, or say this heavy fermion that we need to trying to compensate the anomaly and all that? To what extent, you know, this prediction that you have here can depend on these details?
Well, it can depend, it cannot depend. Depends how fine-tuned the model you want. So if you take the minimal case of this model, the prediction will be only logarithmically dependent on the quartic coupling of the Peachy-Quinn field. If you take and the logarithmic dependence comes from the fact that, as we'll see later, strings depend. So the energy stored in strings depends only logarithmically on the Wi-Fi physics. Mm-hmm. But generically, this fact that the axon is homogeneous model independent. And I think you can always cook up some models where, for example, you don't restore the Peachy-Quinn symmetry.
Yeah, but for example, KSVZ and the other one, the popular models.
Yes.
Is there any difference?
No. For these models, you restore the Peachy-Quinn symmetry, and if it's broken at temperatures larger than Fe, then you will get this no inhomogeneity in the axon field.
But I agree. But in principle, you are saying that there is one-to-one correspondence. So you basically can predict FA in principle exactly. Yeah, if you can calculate exactly. This prediction, sensitive it will be.
Yeah. Okay. This is the core of the talk. So omega A is in principle a linear function of FA. A approximation of a linear function, a quadratic function, but then that depends also on the details of the QCF transition.
Ah, so I see.
In
Thank you.
So in principle, it's a one-to-one correspondence. In practice, you have to understand the evolution of the axon field, which will be the following slides.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Well, if you mean that the function is not monotonic, you can get the same like Mathematical balance for two values of FA. Do you mean something like that, or I mean, if it's not monotonic, you can if you invert it, you can put more than one value. I don't know if you mean this thing or.
Sergey may have disconnected. Can I follow up with that question?
Yes.
This is Cliff talking. So I know these are not the strings that you have in mind, but supposing that we're interested in fundamental strings, which is often the motivation for some of these many axions that are around. Then, yes. In those theories, the axions kind of emerge as Kalb-Ramon fields or something in the extra dimensions, and they never really were part of a scalar field, which you had a UV phase like you described. So is it going to be important in what you say that there had been a phase at higher energies where these things were just the phase of some scalar field that got a VEV like that?
So you're asking essentially if string theory can produce these.
I'm thinking that in most strings, the most axions coming from string theory, I would not necessarily expect there to have been a phase at high energies where they were just the phase of some scalar field. Because once I'm at those energies, I might have had to deal with all of string theory, and it might not have been so simple as having a scalar field. So I'm wondering to what extent you're relying on the existence of that phase.
So in the results that I will show you afterwards, we rely on the fact that the axion is the phase of the sort of complex scalar field with a maximum potential and so on. The naive answer is that whatever is the UV computational, so for most of the UV computational of the axion, since the relic abundance is not very sensitive, I mean, except for this overall FA factor is not very sensitive on the UV completion, I think for most of the axion theories, as long as you produce these inhomogeneities, will not be dependent on the UV completion.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at. When you say that the things don't depend on the UV completion, it sounds like as long as the UV completion includes a phase where the axion was a phase of a scalar field. But if there was a different UV completion, then all bets are off. Is that right?
Well, it could be that the axion is composite, is not comes from.
No, I'm thinking of just in string theory, fundamental string theory. These things are coming as x-dimensional components of an anti-symmetric tensor field. And there never was a scalar field in which they.
Yeah, in that case, probably the one should do a different analysis if they're not.
Okay, that's fair enough. Thank you.
But I mean, we don't know whether the axion comes from that thing. Okay. So as I said, it's another in inhomogeneities in the axon field and within the horizon, and the axon, as I said, is periodic of period 2 pi FA, and as a result, there will be in general thin configurations in initial conditions where the axon wraps on trivially the fundamental domain minus pi and pi, like in this blue circle, and by continuity, there should be at least one point inside a circle where the axon field is not defined, like in this red dot. And if you do the same reason in the whole space, there should be a line of points where this happens, this configuration is called axion string, and it's such that if you go around with a loop in space, the axon gets a shift of 2 pi FA.
I ask you a related question, Cliff and Sergey. What happens if you have, it's not really a UV completion question. What happens if you have a non-trivial vacuum structure for the axion potential in low energies?
What do you mean non-trivial?
So let's say that here you assume that the zero identifies with a 2 pi point.
Yes.
What happens if you have more than one non-trivial vacuum in between?
Okay, so this is, in the discussion, There are two scales. One is the scale of the Pechenegov symmetry breaking. The other is the scale is FA, which is the periodicity of the axon potential. So these are, and these two scales are different.
And no, the, you're right. You're right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it won't matter if you hit the QCD phase transition or something. This is what you're
so the at high energies, the fact that the potential is negligible.
It
doesn't really matter.
Yeah, you're right.
But the lower energy, when potential potential becomes relevant, this form domain walls more than one. Okay. Anyway, at this pace, we'll never finish. Anyway.
don't worry about that. So we all any question time will be discounted. So you will have extra time. Don't worry about it.
Okay. Okay. So these strings have a thickness which is called string call size, which is of the order of the inverse of MR, which where MR is generally the mass of the heavy modes that you will compute the axon theory, and in the case in which the axon theory is you will compute just with a pitching quill field, a complex scalar field phi, with a maximum potential that breaks spontaneously with pitching quill. Then this mass is also of the order of the of is also the mass of the heavier than mode, and if this pressure quill field has order one parameter, so order one complex quadratic coupling, this mass is also of the order of the phi. So in general, this this core is of the inverse of the mass of the new degrees of freedom. In practice, if you take a Hilbert theory with the order one parameters, this mass is also of the order of a phi. So these strings have store quite some energy in them, and this energy is usually expressed in terms of the so-called string tension mu, which is defined to be the energy of the strings per unit length. And notoriously, this string tension has two contributions, two multiplicative contributions. One coming from the core, coming from the fact that the radial mode in this model is on the top of the maximum potential in some points in space. Particularly in the core, and therefore contributes to the Hamiltonian. And then there's another contribution, which comes from the axon gradient. So around the string, the axon gradient is not vanishing at arbitrary large distances from the center of the string. And this gives a contribution to the Hamiltonian, which is logarithmically divergent with the center of the string. And this is given by the log of d over m to the minus 1, where d is the IR cutoff. And in the other universe, this cutoff is at the distance between the strings which have opposite orientation, or if the strings form a loop, at the radius of the loop, because that's where the distance where that's where the axon gradient gets cancelled, and therefore in the other universe, this tension is pi f squared and log of MR h, because the average distance is over the Hubble, as we will see later. So the question you asked earlier, so you see that there's a dependence on MR, which is only logarithmic. So essentially, MR is, if you want, the quartic coupling, square root of quartic coupling of this maximum potential times FA. And as a result, if you want to play with AV completion lowering the quartic coupling, you only get a logarithmic change in the string tension, which then would give only a logarithmic change in the final abundance, if that was more clear. So this string tension actually grows logarithmically in time because h diminishes in time. So you expect that at later times, when h diminishes, the Hubbleize increases and the string tension correspondingly increases logarithmically. So these strings also, although they're stable by themselves, when they're taken together, they can interact between each other, forming bands or loops that subsequently shrink. This process is called the string recombination. And the result of this process is the total reduction of the string length, and the conversion of the energy that is stored in the strings, in the tension of the strings, into axon waves, which are essentially axon radiation, which then are interpreted as axion particles and will make up a part of the relic abundance observed nowadays. So after they are formed, these strings enter a so-called scaling regime, which is defined to be a regime where there is an approximately constant number of strings per double volume. And the reason is the following. So as the Hubble parameter diminishes, the Hubble horizon grows, and the strings that were previously disconnected between each other would enter each other's horizon. And as a result, you start annihilating with this recombination process. And you expect them to enter a sort of equilibrium, which is defined by a state where the rate at which strings enter into each other's horizon is balanced by the rate at which strings shrink and annihilate, such a way that inside the Hubble horizon, there is an approximately constant number of strings of a volume, and this number is approximately conserved. So as we see in the following, this scaling regime plays an important role in our discussion, and is also reached asymptotically in the universe. So it's a cosmological attacker. It doesn't depend on the details of the initial conditions, but will be asymptotically reached. So during the scaling regime, energy is continuously emitted from strings into axions with this recombination process. And by the quiet energy conservation and the fact that there's a constant number of strings of the volume, which I call Xi, and I will define a bit better later, one can also calculate what is the rate at which energy must be emitted in order to maintain the scaling. And this rate is essentially the difference between the energy of free strings and the strings in the scaling regime. And it's given by Xi mu over T cube, where Xi is a dimensionless number, which I will describe later. Mu is pi log pi fa squared log of mr of h, and t is a time, cosmic time. So the situation is the following. After they are formed, the string, when the temperature of Hubble at the world of fa, as a result of the Chepechev symmetry breaking or quantum fluctuations during inflation, at this time, the log of mr of h is respectively between 1 and 15, and you can think of this like log over phi over h. So after that form, they enter very rapidly this scaling regime, where there is an approximate constant number of strings per volume, and the scaling regime lasts for a long time in log units, until this log of mr of h is about 17. This log of mr of h, you can think of log over phi over h. At this time, the Hubble horizon is the Hubble parameter is of the same order as the axion mass, and the temperature of the universe is that of lambda QCD, and the QCD phase transition happens. At this time, an equator on the domain walls will be attached to strings and annihilates the string system. And during all this process, axions are continuously emitted from strings and make up the relic axions we observe nowadays. So just to show you the dynamics in real time. So in this video, we show the evolution of the system axon strings, and this cube here represents the Hubble horizon that increases in time. And although the total length in strings diminishes, the length of strings inside the Hubble volume remains approximately constant. And this is the result of strings collapsing as soon as they re-enter the cosmic horizon. And as you can see, the dynamics of the system is quite hard to capture analytically, and most likely these kind of numerical simulations are needed to fully understand the evolution. And to be precise, this is the evolution of equation motion in FRW metric in radiation elimination with this Lagrangian. So as I said, at the time of the QCD phase transition, when the axion mass equals Hubble, the axion potential turns on, and this will be the time at which the pre-inflation misalignment starts oscillating around the minimum, if the zero is more than one. And the points in space where the axion is pi, which are present because the axion wraps all the fundamental domain in space, we'll say on the top of the QCD potential. And these points form a two-dimensional surface, which is called domain wall. And for a system of strings and domain walls, as I said, it's more convenient to just annihilate into axions in order to reduce the domain wall tension. As a result, after a few Hubble patches, which is at log equals 70, the system of strings and domain walls just annihilate into axions, and no strings and domain walls are present after this time. Only axions are present. And then they shift almost freely until today. So the question from Mina before, this is the case where when a fame is equal, exactly equal to the value of the Pacini field, which happens in the minimal KSVZ model. So that happens when n equals the number of exotic new fermions charged on a QCD with anomaly is equal to one. But in more complicated models where it's larger than one or in the DFSZ model, the number of domain walls is different. And what happens is that the number of domain walls that are attached to strings is larger than one, and this configuration is stable because each domain wall wants to put the string in different directions, and in the end the configuration is stable unless you introduce another explicit breaking of the pitching point image that lifts the pitching point potential in one direction, which will be the UCC vacuum. So in this more complicated case where FA is not equal to the value of the pitching point potential, you have to introduce extra ingredients not to be ruled out. That's just a second comment. So unfortunately, these numerical simulations I told you before cannot scan the whole evolution, which is until log of our variation equal to 70. And the reason is the following. So in order not to incur into numerical effects, in a numerical simulation, there should be a few lattice points for string core size, which is represented in red. And there should be a few Hubble patches inside the box, which is represented in blue. So these Hubble patches are represented in blue. And this means that log of our H, which should be 70 at the QCD transition, is bound to be only the log of the ratio within the box and the circle, which is about 7 or 8, given that today's numerical capabilities can give us at most 5,000 points per in the box. And of course, this is much less than 70, which is the physical point. So the numerical study, like the simulation I showed you before, can be performed reliably only up until the value of log of Marv H equal to 7. And this means that we are actually no hope of analyzing the dynamics of the destruction of the network at the QCD scale. And therefore we need to content ourselves with a less ambitious goal, which is to calculate only the axions produced during the scaling regime. And even in this case, we still can't reach large log directly. But at least we have an advantage that there is an attractive solution, a scaling solution, where the parameters have a precise scaling laws. So the idea is the following. So numerical simulations should be able to simulate the dynamics of the system from MR from log equal to 1 to 7. There should be enough time between these two logs to understand the dynamics of the attractive solution and extract the properties, in particular the number of strings number volume and the rate of emission into axions and the number density emitted into axions. And then since these scaling parameters are constant in time, except for, as we'll see, logarithmic violations, we're able to reconstruct in principle the scaling regime up until the value, up until the physical point, which is log equals 70. In this discussion, of course, it's obvious that we will neglect the axions emitted at the time of the domain wall creation and annihilation, which is about the QCD transition. And these axions can dominate or may not dominate over the ones produced during the scaling regime, but at least they are there and they are not expected to destroy the axions produced during the scaling regime. So if you want, a drawback of this approach is that we can only get the lower bound on the axon mass, on the axons emitted. And this indeed would be the lower bound of the axons we observe today. So in order to complete this program, we need essentially two ingredients. First, we need to know what is the energy that is instantaneously emitted from strings into axons. And as I told you before, this energy by energy conservation and by the existence of a scaling solution can be related in almost one-to-one correspondence to the number of strings per volume, psi, which we will compute later. Second, we need to understand how this energy density is distributed in different wavelengths, meaning to understand what is the axion energy density spectrum. And this axion energy density spectrum will tell us what is the axion number density, which is released during the skinny regime. And as a third ingredient, we need to understand how this, the energy, the number density that is produced between log 1 and 70 is transmitted in the nonlinear transient that happens at the QCD transition. So as you know, the mass of the axion is relevant until the QCD transition. This means that during the skinny regime, the axions are essentially massless, and this number density will be number density of massless particles. At the QCD transition, the axion potential will turn on, but it's not linear, and therefore, it's not quadratic, and therefore the evolution is not linear, this could have order one effects on the number density. I will cite these order one effects. So I will just describe these three ingredients in details and calculate the number density of axions today. So the first ingredient is the number of strings level volume, which is defined as xi, and is defined to be the string length in one Hubble volume, units of the Hubble radius, over average all the Hubble volumes in the universe. So this configuration, for example, is xi equal to 1, and this xi equal to 2, and so on. And this number of strings level volume is possibly the most clear observable that shows the attractor behavior. So in this plot, I show the evolution of psi as a function of time, which is represented by log of MRH, in two systems, the physical system, which is the important one, and the fat string system, which is essentially a physical system where the radial mode mass, or if you want the quartic cap, is diminishing time as the scale factor. And this fat string system is not physical, but it turns out to have better numerical properties because the string core size remains constant in co-moving coordinates. And these points correspond to the different initial conditions, which are related to different string densities in the initial conditions. So, and as you see, although the xi ranges over many orders of magnitude in initial conditions, it tends asymptotically to a common value. And this behavior is mostly clear in the fast string case where indeed the convergence seems to be almost immediate, but also in the physical case the convergence is clear. And so this is the first manifest proof from first principles that dynamics is asymptotically free from the details of initial conditions and tends to a common value. Of course, this proof is only numerical, but at least it's there. So,
I'll ask you something. Maybe you'll get to it later, but when you said that you get a lower bound on the axion mass to get the right balance, you mean yes. Assuming that you know the right extrapolation of xi?
Yeah, this is the next few slides. Yeah, extrapolation okay. will be next slide, essentially, literally. So although different initial conditions tend to a common value, this common value does not seem to be constant in time. And indeed, I show here the same plot as before for the physical system on linear scale as opposed to logarithmic scale. And as you see, it is clear that xi grows logarithmically in time on the attractor solution, which is shown here in black. This both corresponds to scaling violation, which means that scaling parameter xi is not constant in time, but depends logarithmically in time. And this logarithmic error is essentially extremely clear in the fast string case, where any nonlinear function is a bad fit of this curve, this black curve. And this gives us confidence that the logarithmic run is present. So these lines can be very well fitted with a logarithmic increase plus 1 over log corrections. And in the large logarithmic limit, which is log equals 70, only the logarithmic increase would be relevant. And this would correspond to a number of strings per volume, which is about 15 at log equals 70 with an angle of 2, which is actually much larger than what can be achieved in the simulations, particular would be much larger than one. And for obvious reasons, this would tell us that the energy density in strings would be larger of about this factor at the Christie-Weiss transition.
Marco, why are you assuming this functional dependence? So the log logarithmically, and why 1/log and 1/log²?
Well. This functional dependence is empirical and has no first principles reason. So these 1/log corrections are different for different lines. So in this plot, you see different lines. Mm-hmm. This C minus one, C minus two are the coefficients of the 1/log 1/log² and are chosen to be different in different lines. So if you want this C minus one, C minus two represent in some sense the residual non-logarithmic importance of the initial conditions. But these are an empirical formula. So that's I cannot say more than this. I was saying that actually this logarithmic increase could be due to the fact that there are many properties of the string network that depend on log. In particular, I told you before the string tension is logarithmically sensitive to this log because it's log over Marv H.
Yeah.
And therefore you can think that there are other properties of the string network that depend on this log, in particular yes.
Yeah. The other thing is, how important are these 1/log? If I'm reading the formula correctly, that means the corrections are not important, like at the QCD phase transition, for example.
Yeah. They're not.
So you're important. Dominated by the constant and the first log correction, right?
Yeah. Okay. Unless it, okay. If you see a formula like this, it's okay, but then you have to see what is the numerical values of this C1.
No, I understand, but why didn't you consider a log squared correction, for example?
Yeah. So you can do the same trick with the log squared correction.
Yeah.
Apparently, also the log squared correction fits well, but of course you introduce one more parameter in the fit. So you have to do log squared plus log plus constant, but if you introduce one more parameter in the fit, you get to a better fit, of course, because you have one more parameter.
Sure, of course.
One of the point of this discussion is that even if there's a log square dependence, the number of strings probably would be even larger. It would be not 15, but would be order 50, and still this would give a lower bound. So this 15 is, if you want, still a lower bound on the number of strings at the QCD transition.
I see. So
as you can see very well in this fat string system, the linear increase with log is very clear, and the log square is almost ruled out, unless you really fine tune the coefficient of log and log when you have to. It's not believable that in the fat string system you have logs. Okay. And also, there is actually a nice theoretical expectation of why this log increase. So this you can write down a theory of a fundamental string coupled to an external axiom. So a theory of fundamental string would be a number of a string, and then you can couple to a fundamental axiom radiation. And you can see that the effective coupling of the string coupled to the axion is proportional to 1/log. So in some sense, in this effective theory that actually holds at large value of the log, in some sense you see that the effective coupling of the filament of the string is diminishing like 1/log, and which means that at large value of the log, the string would like the couple from the axion. So it is expected that at log equal to infinity, the strings will behave like free. And the rate at which the strings will behave like free is dictated by this log. Mm-hmm. And indeed, since the axion is decoupling with a rate proportional to log, of course, but log is still a log, it's not parallel. you expect that the number of strings increases because you know, the strings are less efficiently, logarithmic less efficiently to emit energy into axons, and so they will group a bit more logarithmically more in the upper part. So this will be the explanation, and actually I think it's probably the right answer. So the strings couple to the axon with a coupling which is proportional to 1/log, and this would imply that number of strings increases. In particular, at log equal to infinity, they are free.
The other thing, the two that you have in parentheses there, error. I mean, if you're telling me that I could have a log square correction, which would go because
the probability
would go like So then, I mean,
this two is coming from the error on the fit of these coefficients C1, C2, C-1, C-2, and assuming this form of psi. If you change the form of psi, you can get any number you want.
That's not very it doesn't inspire confidence. Can it be? Increasing the number of strings in the scaling regime makes sense. But the question is, how can you formulate your uncertainty a bit better than any numbers?
I mean, we believe that the uncertainty is close to this. Because we believe that this formula is correct, and it is correct because the fat stream system, which is converges immediately to the scaling solution, as this linear log, and the fact that it converges immediately is because essentially you have more cosmic time, since also MR changes in time. So if you buy this thing that there's a linear growth, then this error is correct. If you want to change this linear growth, making quadratic, this will be a lower bound if you want on the number of strings, and not just the precise value, but a lower bound. If you want to make it cubic, you can. There are infinite number of powers. You can imagine.
Yeah.
Right. Then this is the. I think we are pretty confident this is a lower bound on number of strings.
Okay.
And hints from many different directions, both theoretical directions and simulations, that this behavior will go on. Also, there's no additional, so the problem does not have any additional scale. MR and H are the only two scales, so you don't expect actually a point after log equal 9 or 8 where this scaling solution changes. So you still have to reconstruct and extrapolate, but this is the most conservative one. Anyway, so.
Thank you.
Marco, can you say again, what is this fat string model? What changes?
No. You write the Nambu-Goto, if you're familiar. So you write the Nambu-Goto action, which is like essentially, the integral on the worksheet of.
Yes.
Square root of it's the area of the worksheet. Right. Then you couple this corresponds to a string moving in space time. Then you write the coupling of this string, which is an infinitesimal string, to an axion field, which is you can do it minimally. Introducing this two form, so the axion field is embedded in a two form. So in this, the field strength is a three form, and there is a prescription to couple the string to an axion, and then you write down your equation of motion. I don't have it in the slides, but I can show you offline.
This is what you call fat strings.
No. This is the Nambu-Goto approximation. Fat string is another thing. Is the evolution of this equation of motion. The same, the lattice evolution of the Pechenkui field with the quartic coupling changing in time in such a way that the string core remains constant in commoving coordinates. So if you want, it's the radial mode mass, MR, diminishes in time like 1/scale factor. And in this fast string limit, you see that, so in this fast string case, you see that in order to get the same value of log, since also MR diminishes in time, it takes more cosmic time, if you want, because the cosmic time is determined by Hubble. So since also MR changes in time, you have more cosmic time between one log and the other. And this means that the evolution is driven faster towards the Jackson solution. And that's why, so if you want, this in terms of cosmic time, this first part of the fast string corresponds to the whole evolution on the physical string. Just for the way.
Yeah, but is there anything special about decreasing as a scale factor? You can decrease as any function of time, just slower than. Right?
No. So this, we do this because it has a better numerical property. So in the sense that the string trick is such that the string, so we do the simulation in commoving coordinates.
I see.
In commoving coordinates, it's better if you have a scale which is constant commoving coordinate.
Mm-hmm.
If you decrease MR in time this way, the core stays constant in commoving coordinates. So it's a trick to make the simulation better. But
I see. Thanks.
Yeah. Just a quick comment. Going back to the log squared thing, I think I'm sympathetic to you that it's linear in log, but if it were true that you were entertaining a quadratic thing, the argument that you're making a lower bound isn't such a strong one, right? Because you don't know that the coefficient of the log squared would be positive, and there could be a cancellation happening. So it really is true that you have a prior which is a reasonable prior, but it's. I think you don't want to push too hard the argument.
It cannot be negative because xi cannot be negative.
So. Right. So your theory of whatever that large seed behavior will take care of that, right? But there'll be a theory.
But if you do the fit with the C2 positive, okay, C2 will be the log square. If you do the prior in C2 positive, I think you still get an answer, no?
Well, yeah, but you put a prior in there. So I'm just saying that I wouldn't sell too hard that the reason for there being a log is that you're getting a lower bound. I think you have some information as to what you think the Lark C behavior is, which is your prior, and it's based on evidence. And so that's not a bad argument, right?
Yeah. But as another argument, if you want, it's the fact that if you put also log square, you cannot get a lower number of psi. In the fit, you cannot get a lower number of psi. Because
why not? Why can't I have I can design functions which have higher powers of log c where I'll make the coefficients, some of them will be negative.
Okay. You know, if you
it's a prior, right? So you've got actually a very good prior. You should stick with it.
Yeah. Okay. You have a line up to the number 8. You can do whatever you want after the number 8. That's the statement. I mean, it's a line, and you have to extrapolate it, and the prior is that is log. Okay. Okay, so the second ingredient, which we need, is the axon energy density spectrum, 0a in KDT, which describes how the axons that are emitted from strings are distributed over different wavelengths. And there are actually some theoretical expectations for this axon energy density spectrum. So the first expectation for the shape of the spectrum, the first expectation is that the spectrum should have natural cutoffs at momenta which has more than Hubble, at momenta that are larger than MR. And the reason for this is that you cannot emit wavelengths that are larger than Hubble horizon by causality, and you cannot emit wavelengths that are smaller than MR minus one because it's the smallest scale in the problem. And then we also expect that spectrum has a peak at momenta over the Hubble because strings have average curvature over the Hubble, and so you expect them to emit wavelengths of the sort. And in between, since there are not other scales between Hubble and MR, you can expect that the spectrum is approximated just with a single power law, which I parameterize like 1 over k to the q. And q is also called the spectral index. And this q plays an important role in our discussion. It's called it determines the hardness of the spectrum, which means that if the spectrum is UV-dominated or IR-dominated. So if Q is larger than 1, the spectrum is IR-dominated, and most of the energy, which is emitted from strings into axions, again, determined by Xi, is stored in momenta over the Hubble. On the other hand, if Q is smaller than 1, the spectrum is UV-dominated, and most of the energy is stored in momenta, in UV momenta over the MR, if you want FA. And in these two cases, the number density is very different. So in the first case, the number density is made of axions, of many axions. Each one has a momentum over the Hubble. In the second case, only a few axions are emitted. Each one has a UV momentum. And this is essentially the expression of a number density. Depending on the energy distribution of these axions, you get completely different number densities. And the first case, Q less than one, and the second case, Q more than one, have a number density that is a part of exponentially large values, like e to the minus 70. And it is therefore clear to understand whether the spectrum is UV or IR dominated to make any sensible prediction. And in principle, there could be a time dependence of the spectral index Q on log, since there are many other properties of the network that depend on log, particular psi depends on log, and the string tension depends on log, so it's quite unreasonable to think that Q doesn't depend on log. So in this plot, I show the result of the spectrum. So this is the energy density spectrum as a function of the momentum normalized by Hubble at different times. So which are represented by log 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. And as you see, the expectation, the expectations are met. In particular, the spectrum has momenta at each time, as a peak of momenta at each time over the Hubble. And then there are two cutoffs at momenta more than Hubble, as larger than MR over 2, which is this point. In between, you can see that a power law forms, and you can calculate this power law. However, this power law does not seem to be constant in time. And indeed, I show here in this plot the evolution of the spectral index in time, which is again represented by log. And although the spectral index is less than one during the whole range, particular small logs, and in the simulations, anomalies running is evident, and this corresponds to a spectrum which is becoming from UV dominated to IR dominated. So on top of the running of Xi, the simulations show a running of Q, and although in the simulation the spectrum is UV dominated, soon after the simulation, in particular at the specialization where log is equal to 70, the spectrum is expected to be IR dominated, and therefore many axions are produced. So a few comments. So first of all, as you can see, the simulations, we still don't get to the point where the Q is larger than one, which will correspond to a spectrum which is IR dominated. And the point Q, if you want to extrapolate these lines, the point Q larger than one would appear just after a few e-foldings, if you want. But still, in these final points, there are few simulations in the average that have Q larger than one, because this is an average of many simulations, and some of them have Q larger than one. And as a result, it's impossible to believe that Q saturates at one, because some of them have Q larger than one. So the most conservative extrapolation of these lines is that Q is larger than one at log equal 70, and actually soon after the range of the simulations. So this spectrum, which will become IR dominated, is an expectation, again, from this effective theory of Nabokov-Gotha strings coupled to an axion field, because you can show in this effective theory that string loops oscillate many times before disappearing. And why they oscillate many times? They would emit wavelengths that are only of the order of the initial loop size, which is, in this case, over the Hubble. And therefore, they would emit wavelengths which would form an IR dominated spectrum. And they forget about the string size. Also, the precise value of Q is not very important to make a prediction, as long as Q is definitely larger than one. And therefore, we don't actually need to understand what is the exact extrapolation of these lines up to the physical point. We just assume, so there's evidence from these analysis that Q is larger than one at log equals 70, and this evidence is supported by number go to strings coupled to an external axiom field. And these first simulations are actually the first nice proof of how this Nabucco limit is reached from a field theoretic point of view. So last, I want to discuss the final ingredient, which is to understand the number density and how this number density evolves during the nonlinear regime. So at when the Hubble is equal to the axon mass, which I call H star, the axon field is made of three ingredients. First, there are all the waves that are emitted during the scaling regime. Then there are strings and domain walls. And of course, at this point, we cannot understand evolution because the thickness of the string is much smaller than Hubble horizon. So in the following, I will focus therefore only on the evolution of the waves that are produced during the scaling regime, and which I assume to have a spectrum that is determined by Q larger than one and Xi equal 15. So I will focus on the evolution of these waves that are produced during the scaling regime and with Xi equal to 15 and an IR dominated spectrum, which are the most conservative extrapolations of the previous analysis. So at this time, the pre-inflation in this alignment will start oscillating. So at this time, the energy density in these waves is of a kind Xi mu over T squared by just energy conservation. And if you write in terms, if you write mu in terms of log and Fe, this is like a kind 10 to the 3 for Xi log of 10 to the 3 times H of Fe squared, we're writing T in terms of Hubble. And this energy density is stored in the gradient of the axon field. So this energy density at H star is actually much larger than ma squared A phase squared, which is the typical energy density of the pre-inflation misalignment for theta zero over the one. It is also of the order of the axon potential, which is bound since it's a cosine. And as a result, at H star, the energy density that is stored in the field is mostly stored in the gradients. And at H star, the potential is negligible because the Hamiltonian is dominated by the gradients. This is as opposed to the pre-inflation misalignment, where instead the gradient energy and the potential energy are the same order soon after H star. So this means that since the Hamiltonian is dominated only by the gradient terms and the potential is negligible, the field will not feed the potential and will just evolve, these waves will just evolve relativistically until a point which we call HL, and which is the time at which this relativistic left shift, so the gradient energy is equal to the potential energy, which in the meantime increases since the axon mass increases. So at this time, all the terms in the Hamiltonian are the same order, the gradient and the potential, and therefore you need to solve the equation of motion numerically. However, after a nonlinear transient, where again, since the potential is nonlinear, should be simulated numerically, you expect the field to go in the non-relativistic regime. So you expect the amplitude of the field to go around, to go below FA, much below FA. And you expect that the number density of non-relativistic axioms is conserved. So this behavior is an anomalous behavior compared to the pre-inflation misalignment, where instead the non-relativistic regime for theta zero over the one happens soon after H star. Due to the fact that there are so many axioms produced, the potential is negligible up until a later time, and therefore the fields shift more compared to the pre-fisherman misalignment.
Marco, I'm a bit confused about what is actually large. So you are saying that you are getting that the energy density is much larger than h square times f a square. Yeah.
But
the gradients are IR dominated. Yes. Yeah? So the dominant gradients are 1/H. Yeah. So like the characteristic wavelength is 1/H.
Yeah.
So the gradient is h. So what? The amplitude is large. It's much larger than f a.
Yeah. That's the next slide. The amplitude is large. The axion has a large amplitude, much larger than FA, and then it's missed.
But what does it mean? How can it have amplitude much larger than FA? It's a cyclic coordinate.
It means that the axion wraps so more than one fundamental domain.
Uh-huh.
And would the next slide. Okay. It per se is a periodic variable. So in our conception, it goes from zero to pi. But it can wind and wind more times the fundamental domain, and the gradients see that. Anyway, the number. So this.
This. Can I also ask a question?
Yes.
Yeah. So like for like your this slide, like how important is the assumption that it is somewhat homogeneous? Because in reality, it's not really homogeneous, right? Like the gradient.
What is homogeneous?
The gradient, like there are regions where like the gradient is much bigger and the gradient is much smaller, right?
The gradient is not homogeneous by definition of gradient.
I'm just saying the energy density is not homogeneous like in this in the region you are considering, right?
What do you mean? In this evolution at H star, the waves that are not homogeneous, that have an amplitude which is given by this energy density, and a covariance length if you want wavelength which is over the Hubble, and the question is how important is that?
I'm just saying a gradient of A, like at a different location can be very, very different, right?
No, this gradient of A, this gradient of A means that, there's a short notation to mean the integral d3x of gradient of A of x integrated over all space divided by the volume. So this is the Hamiltonian, this is just a number. This is a number, which is the energy density, which is much larger than. I now understand. So you mean that there can be points that where the gradient is zero. So specific point where the gradient is zero, and in the specific points,
places where it's very, very large, right?
Where it's very large, this approximation holds. When it's zero, the number of points which is zero is of measure zero, so you don't see. But there can be regions of space where actually the gradient is smaller than V. But these essentially make is a small percentage of the points. So this argument of kinetic energy much larger than potential energy, just an argument looking at the pieces in the Hamiltonian. So there's a piece in the Hamiltonian that dominates over the other. Then if you look at the equation of motion, there can be points where the gradient is zero. The potential in the equation of motion dominates. But the exact answer is that you have to actually solve numerically the equation of motion, which I will do in two slides. And you see that this behavior is actually realized independently of the fact that there are some points where the gradient is zero.
Okay, I can't wait to ask this.
If I answer, sure. The fact that this left shift will hold independently of whether there are few points where the gradient is zero. Boom. I mean, most of the points have a gradient much, much larger than the majority of them. Anyway, so we can get actually So despite this there is non-linear transient, we can actually get an analytical prediction for the number density, which turns out to be remarkably accurate. So the number density at the time HL, assuming that all these relativistic redshifts end at HL and then the axons become non-relativistic, can be written as the energy density rho A at HL over the mass at HL. This is an assumption, but of course we will verify it with numerical simulations. And at HL, the mass is calculated, it can be calculated by the definition of HL, which is obtained by equating these two equations. And as you see, it's like a square root of phi log. You just eliminate FA and the square root. And if you plug this formula, you get the number density at the time HL, after which the field is non-relativistic, is of the kind square root of psi log HFA squared, where I remind you, HFA squared is the order of magnitude of the number density in the pre-inflation is aligned for theta zero over the one. So as you see, this relativistic shift as an effect of diminishing the number density of a factor square root of psi log with respect to the case where the axon evolved linearly. Of course, since psi log is large, this will still dominate over the misalignment, which is HFA squared. And the reason for this is that during this relativistic redshift, the amplitude of the axon field redshifts more compared to the non-relativistic case, because of, you know, that the energy densities have one scale factor difference. One was square factor for the cube, and therefore the energy density diminishes more. At the same time, the axon mass grows, and therefore more energy is required to produce each axon, and you get a subtraction factor, which is this estimate, this group of Psi-log. But still, this energy, this number density, dominates over the misalignment. So summarizing, although at the time H star the energy density is psi log larger than the misalignment, due to this relativistic redshift at HL, the number density is only a factor square root of psi log larger compared to the misalignment. So as Sergei was suggesting, the dynamics of the axon waves is quite richer than what I just described. Because of the fact that the axon is periodic. So at the time HL, so at the time H star, in order for the gradient energy, where the gradients are over the Hubble, to equate the energy emitted from strings, which is Xi log extra Fa squared, H over 2 pi Fa should be of order Xi log by just this equation, and which is of order 10. And as a result, since the axon is periodic, this means that the axon field is a superposition of waves that wind and unwind trivially the fundamental domain minus pi and pi several ways, order 10 ways. But and therefore we form domain walls. But these domain walls, if you want, are trivial because they connect the same vacuum, which is at a equal to zero. So although these domain walls are trivial, they are still present and they must be taken into account. So actually, at the time H star, the field looks like this. So this is the field shown in the region minus pi and pi, where pi is yellow, minus pi is blue, and zero is green, is a vacuum. And as you see, in between these points, the field overtakes a domain wall in an onion-like structure. And note that these are not the domain walls that are attached to strings, which are, we are neglecting this analysis. These are additional domain walls that arise because the axon amplitude is larger than FA because there are so many axons produced.
So what is this picture? So you generated the random field using the spectrum that you postulated.
Yeah, no. So this is completely fixed. This picture is a supervision of waves with the energy density spectrum that is they constructed for from the screen regime. So the energy density spectrum is the one which is IR dominated with the xi, which corresponds to xi equal to 15. So you just take the energy density spectrum, you translate it in a configuration, in a field configuration with the random phases. That's really you have to put the random phases. So these domain walls are actually additional to the domain walls that are attached to strings, which are we are neglected in this analysis because again, strings cannot be simulated. During this subsequent evolution, so after the star, when the field shifts relativistically, these domain walls and the field will evolve as a free relativistic field, and these domain walls will actually as free, but at a certain point they will be important. So this, by the way, the equation of motion that we're solving numerically in the following slide. So in the subsequent evolution, the axon amplitude will diminish, will go down, and the domain walls will evolve until the point where the potential energy is equal to the gradient energy, HL. At each time, so the domain walls start interacting with each other, collapsing, and the field will relax everywhere in the minimum, except in some points where the domain walls collide, and these points are the seeds for what is called oscillons. So these oscillons are points in space where the axon oscillates with an amplitude which is over the pi fa, which are the remnants of these domain walls that are present again because the axon amplitude was large. These oscillons have a size which is the inverse of the axon mass, so they are very rapidly very small, and they only contribute to a very small percentage of the space, and everywhere else the axon is in the minimum, which is zero. So the result of the redshift is that the domain walls evolve as free, and at the time HL, when there's the nonlinear transient, the nonlinear transient has the effect of destroying the domain walls and producing oscillons from them. However, this transient is very fast, and conservation of a number density is from at HL is almost a good approximation. So that essentially these oscillons can be neglected. So after this evolution of these waves, you can calculate what is the number density of axons and compare it with the previous estimate, which told us that it was an answer of the root of Snell compared to this alignment. And you can neglect oscillons from the field. And in this plot, I show you the ratio between the number density of axons from strings divided by the misaligned number density at theta 0 equal to 1, which is a fixed number, a reference number, for different value of psi log, which I call psi star log star, which is about 10 to the 3 for the QC axiom, since xi 15 log 17. And as you see, the points are the results from the nonlinear simulation I just showed. And this, the error comes from the difference from considering the oscillons or not considering the oscillons. And as you see, the error is invisible, and therefore the oscillons don't contribute a lot to the number density. And also you see that these lines correspond to the analytic estimate we made before and fit very well the numerical results. And actually the result for the number density can be just taken from our analytic estimate instead of relying on simulations. And as you see, simulations and analytic estimate tell us that for the QC axon, which is for x0 between 5 and 10, this is the IR cutoff of the spectrum, there is an enhancement of about 2 times 10 to the 2 compared to the misalignment. And this is a strong proof coming from omega simulations and from analytic estimate that that strings emit more axons than the alignment. So I will not have time.
Marco, I'm a bit confused. So why the enhancement is so large? You said it should be square root of xi log, right?
I deliberately didn't say many things. So this is an estimate. This is an estimate. This is another odd time factor here, which you can calculate. Okay. It's square root of xi log. It's square root of 10 to the 3, which is, I guess, 30.
Even 2 pi. There is some 2 pi.
Yeah, there are other one factors. But so the idea of this analytic estimate is that you calculate the number density at the time when the energy density in the gradient and in the potential are the same. So you can actually calculate analytically, which is the energy density in the gradient, as a function of order one parameters. Then you impose it equal to the energy density in the potential up to another one factor. And then you measure this order one factor from the simulations. And it turns out indeed to be order one. And also this behavior of xi log is not exactly square root of xi log, but it's also a correction coming from the dependence of the axon mass on temperature. So essentially the axon mass grows in the meantime. So if you do properly this estimate, in this MA, you have to consider also the fact that this growth. We did it properly, not like in this slide, and we found that the numerical solution is completely compatible with the analytic estimate. And we fitted the coefficient, which I did over the one from the numerical solution.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, thanks.
So, okay, we are, I think, over time, but I will say this also. So there are some interesting results about the final spectrum of axions after the Noether regime. So the Noether regime and the this transient have the effect of changing the shape of the axion spectrum. So this dashed line corresponds to the axon spectrum before the precipitation transition before H star, and these solid lines correspond to the axon spectrum after the precipitation after this nonlinear transient, and these dot points correspond to the mass at the time HL, which is the mass of the axion at the time when this nonlinear regime kicks in, and these different lines correspond to different values of xi log, which is for the axon 10 to the 3. And as you see, the result of the nonlinear transient is to diminish the amplitude of the spectrum at the momenta which are smaller than the mass at the time HL. And you can think of this effect as an effect of the nonlinear interactions of the potential. So these nonlinear interactions, in order to conserve energy, they have to not conserve the number density, and therefore the axions that have momentum smaller than the mass group to each other, combine to form an axion with this mass, and in order to combine, they have to diminish their number, and therefore the amplitude of the field at these modes diminishes. And this means that the axon spectrum is not picked at the moment of where the Hubble at H star, but it's picked at momenta which are a bit larger and is a bit more UV. And this has, of course, probably effects in the subsequent evolution of the field, so for many clusters and oscillons.
What is KCOM?
This is the commoving momentum. It was just to say that in whatever units are in the x-axis, this is the momentum in units of Hubble, and this the momentum corresponding to the mass at the time when the linear transient kicks in, and all the momenta which are smaller than this momentum, which is fixed, get destroyed because axions of those momenta combine to create an axion with a certain mass with your mass, and therefore the amplitude diminishes. And as you see, also these points here correspond to the value of the mass at the final time, and these lines up and down correspond to screening or non-screening the oscillons which are present in the field. And as you see, oscillons don't make a large part of the energy density, and therefore for the only purpose of calculating the number density don't matter. Probably they're more important for the subsequent evolution of the field, because these oscillons are thought to oscillate many times before disappearing, and there might be seeds for structures. This is speculative. So finally, I want to give to show this final plot, which is the bound on the axion mass. So here I showed the axion mass in electron volt. It's a function of capital photons. Capital photon doesn't matter in this discussion, but it's only to show what is the impact for current experiments, which are currently running experiments and for the future proposed. So if you remember, in the pre-Fisher misalignment for the theta zero equal to one, the decay constant predicted that makes up the full right density is about 10 to the 12 GeV. And since the relation between the decay constant and the dark matter abundance was almost linear, and since we saw that this is about a factor of 10 to the 2 large abundance, this means that the constant should be reduced or about a factor of 10 to the 2. And as a result, in order not to overcruise dark matter, FA should be smaller than 10 to the 10, which corresponds to a mass of about 0.5 milliarton volt for the minimal model where this number of domain walls is equal to 1, which is also the minimal case in Z model. And this will correspond to this line here. For the DFSZ model, where n is equal to 6, because you know it's the generation, the number of generation, to the fact that standard model fragments are charged under the Tessier queen, the bound is stronger because what actually enters in the calculation is not a FA, but again is a web of the Tessier queen field, which is an after a factor of 6, and therefore, in order to not produce dark matter, you need to have even smaller FA, and this corresponds to this line, and 3.5 milliarton volt. And as you see, there is still a small region between these points and the supernova bound, which will correspond about 10ths of milliarton volt. And therefore, this motivates to look at experiments in this window to possibly exclude the scenario forever, if you want. Moreover, I want to point out that we are neglecting the axions that are produced by the domain walls of textual strings. These axions may or may not dominate over those that are produced during the scaling regime. If they dominate, then the predictions are in this green shaded region. If they instead are irrelevant, these numbers here correspond to exact predictions for the exact prediction for the. For the axion mass in the scenario. So if you want, there's still some uncertainty because the domain walls are not taken into account. But if they give a contribution of the same order and not much larger, then these predictions can be taken quite solidly. However, we still don't know the subsequent evolution on these domain walls attached to strings. Okay, concluding, so we're shown that several things in these projects. So the first of all is that the system of action strings is driven towards an attractive solution, which is independent of initial conditions, and is independent of the details of the Pettier-Quinn symmetry breaking, is independent on how many strings are initially. And on this attractive solution, there are evidence of logarithmic violations in the number of strings double volume and in Q. Particular xi larger and q grow logarithmically in time. And this is in accordance to expectations from number of strings coupled to an external axion field. And the most conservative extrapolations of this behavior, we think implies more actions from strings. Then a second point, we've shown that actions from strings actually experience some linear evolution at the phase transition, because at this point, the axe potential is irrelevant, since so many axons are produced. And this implies a digital shift and a linear transient. And the result of this fact is that there is a partial reduction over the number density, which still dominates over the misalignment, a factor of about the square root of psi log, and makes the spectrum UV dominated, and therefore probably changing the expectation for the subsequent evolution of the field. And in this scenario, the axon mass is in this window, constrained to be in this window between 0.5 and 20 millithermal volt, where the 0.5 comes from dark matter overproduction, and the 20 comes from source of physical balance, in particular supernovae. Relaxing this balance can be tricky. Supernova 1, there are papers about this, but I am not an expert. For the dark matter overproduction, they are probably solid, if you really believe these extrapolations that we believe they are. They're solid. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Marco, for this very good talk. So are there any more questions? Before we stop the recording, we can keep talking with Marco after we stop the recording, but if there are any pressing questions now? Okay, so there were lots of questions already. I'm going to just stop the recording, and whoever wants to leave, please feel free to leave. Otherwise, the rest of us will just stay here or move to the PI lunch discussion link. If you don't have it, please let me know.
Okay, I'm here.
Thanks, Marco. That was a very nice talk.